Good evening, everybody. This is Dr. Dennis Tien. This is the Doctor of Football Podcast. I'm here with the Hedge Better CEO, Justin Fine. We're recording remotely tonight. Justin, how you doing?
You know, I'm not too happy to be back in the cold. Just got back from Arizona. Very nice down there. So I'm adjusting to no football and cold weather now. So
this is the post-Super Bowl edition, post-Justin's Friends Bachelor Party edition of the podcast. Justin, how was Scottsdale? We talked a little bit about last week. Did it meet your expectations?
It really did. It was definitely a good time. For sure a good place to go, you know, especially in the winter, just to get away. And the Waste Management Open, man, I got to tell you, that was one hell of an event. Even if you don't like golf, that's definitely a good place to go down and have yourself a good time.
Nice. Awesome, man. Awesome. Well, listen, let's get right to it. We had a big game this weekend, Super Bowl, last NFL game until the preseason next August. Always a depressing, somber time of year. We're still far enough away from spring and summer that this is kind of like a real, kind of like the darkest part of the calendar right now before we finally get to spring and certainly the March Madness coming up. But this is really a kind of a hole in the sports calendar.
For sure, for sure. Arguably, I mean, one of the worst times, unless you're like a diehard NBA or NHL fan, like this is tough.
Or a winter sports person, like people that love to ski love this time of year. But unless you're like really into skiing and winter sports, what about the Olympics, Justin? You watching the Olympics at all? I'm not watching at all.
Not at all. Nothing. Yeah. Nothing about it is piquing my interest, if we're being completely honest.
All right. Well, let's get right into the Super Bowl. This was an interesting matchup going into the game. You know, it felt really interesting to me because it didn't quite feel like it had the intensity of other Super Bowls, but at the same time, it was a good matchup, and I felt like it was going to be a good competitive game, and it was a good competitive game. The first half was exciting. There was a halfback pass for a touchdown. Rams hit a few big plays, a lot of back and forth. It was great. But what I was really struck by, Justin, was in the third quarter of this game, the Bengals came out in the second half. They made a huge play at the start of the half on the 75-yard T. Higgins touchdown. Then they got an interception on a deflected pass. Okay, it looked like the Bengals had really just kind of like stepped up and said, we're taking this game. We want to win it. Okay. And then the game at that point, from like 4 minutes into the third quarter on, went into this like, it was like a game of like Pong. It was like just back and forth where nothing happened for like a quarter and a half until there was 4 minutes in the fourth quarter. And it was like a good solid quarter in two thirds of the game where it was just a complete like stalemate, you know, three and out, match for three and out, match for three and out. I didn't think it was entertaining. I didn't think it was interesting, and it didn't feel like a Super Bowl. It felt like neither team really wanted to win the game. So Justin, what did you think? Am I wrong? Did this Super Bowl feel to you like it felt to me, that it just lacked that kind of like Super Bowl intensity, especially in the second half?
100%. And it's funny to say that because it was a close game the whole way. It came down to the final drive. You know, it was back and forth. Like, it had all of the characteristics, a good blend of offense and defense, a couple big plays, pretty much all the boxes that you would check, you know, for an ideal Super Bowl. I think for me, the disconnect is that I'm watching the game and I just strongly don't think that either of those teams were the two best teams in the NFL this year or currently, were the two most capable teams. So I don't know. For me, like, that was kind of the thing. It was like I was watching a Super Bowl with two teams that I felt like were almost like understudies for the two teams that should be there, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And I think that's one of the things maybe that why it felt that way, because even though it was a super competitive, entertaining game, and you know, more than anything, you don't want to see a blowout in the Super Bowl. And that's happened many times, including last year. And it really takes away from the experience. So just to even have a competitive game is really the goal. But I think you're right. A part of it was the fact that these aren't marquee teams. You could argue they might not have been the best teams. They didn't really have the brightest stars. They were good teams, but really not great ones. And maybe that was a part of why it was so so kind of blah coming down the stretch in this game. Can I throw out another one? And maybe this is just totally ridiculous, but you know, not to be that fan that's like complaining about the announcers, but I just felt like Chris Collinsworth and Al Michaels called this game like it was a preseason game. I mean, there was just no like enthusiasm, no intensity. I'm not one to typically complain about the announcer as far as I'm concerned. If the game is good, I don't care about the announcer, but I really just felt like they were just, it was just so like perfunctory and matter of fact to them. I just couldn't help but seep into how I experienced the game. I didn't think that they really did a great job of bringing that Super Bowl level excitement. You know, I don't know what you thought about that.
No, I actually agree with that completely. And, you know, I'll take it a step further and say, not only just the announcers, but like the atmosphere of the game itself, like LA doesn't have a loyal fan base out there. They've had a tough time filling the seats, even in the playoffs, to the point where they were trying to ban 49ers fans and non-LA residents from buying tickets to the conference championship, right? So, like, you have a team that's, you know, supposedly at home, and if you're at home in the Super Bowl, that crowd should be roaring. That place should be thunderous. Like, every big play should, you know, that arena should erupt. I really didn't hear much, like, you know what I mean? Like, there wasn't much of that. So I just feel like overall it was just a very, like you said, like very lackluster. Like, it as good as the game was and as intense as the game was, I didn't feel the intensity watching it as a fan.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you lose the fans. We're going to talk a little about Rams fans because I think it's a major issue. The LA market is becoming a huge problem for the NFL. It really is. And there were some real indicators of that this week. But the one thing, just to go back to what you alluded to, I mean, it was like a 50-50 split crowd, which, given the fact that it was in one of the team's home stadium, is absolutely stunning that as many fans traveled across the continent from Cincinnati to LA to watch the Bengals as did drive 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes away to watch the home team. And I think that's amazing. And let's be honest, Justin, we're talking about the Bengals here. That isn't exactly the Steelers or the Cowboys, or the Patriots or the Packers, one of these teams that travels well. It's the Bengals. They don't have, I mean, they have real fans. And that's one of the reasons I was kind of rooting for them, to be honest with you, because I'm like, hey, Bengals fans deserve a championship, but they have real fans, but they're not a huge fan base either. So the fact that they were able to come across the continent and out, you know, show the home team's fans, it's stunning. All of those things, the announcers, the crowd, the teams that were in it, it all kind of led to this just kind of like perfect storm, if you will, to really just make this feel like, I still to this day get so excited for the Super Bowl. It's a special, like, day. It's a special experience. Just the idea that a championship is going to be crowned on that night. It's unique to the NFL because everyone else has a 7-game series. It's a one night thing. I mean, that intensity, that excitement, that buzz is like nothing really else in pro sports. And in my opinion, it really wasn't there on Sunday. It really wasn't there. It was very ho-hum, perfunctory, you know, okay, we won, great. You know, it was not the same magical experience that we've seen, you know, really as recently as last year.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And, you know, again, it's funny because we're saying all this and people, you know, might be saying, well, what are you guys talking about? It really was a good game. And again, yes, technically it was a really good game. And if that was a regular season game, that would have been a great regular season game to watch. But it just didn't have the Super Bowl level hype in buzz, and just, the atmosphere was just flat all around.
Well, that's exactly it. I felt like I was watching any other Sunday night game.
Right.
And it was entertaining. I watched Sunday Night Football pretty much every week. That's a regular Sunday night, Monday night game. You're waking up the next morning saying, what a great game last night. That was a great game.
For sure.
But it's just, it wasn't the quality of the game or what would happen on the field. It was just that buzz, that extra pitch that a Super Bowl typically has that just wasn't there. It didn't have that punch. And I think you really feel it. I really do. Let's talk, Justin, a little bit about some of the things that happened in the game. Yep. There was a couple key plays, couple key points in this game that I thought really, were really key inflection points, if you will, in what ended up happening. I want to start with your boy, Joe Burrow, because I watched the game. And I'm just going to be honest here. I felt like as I was watching him, said, this guy really isn't doing anything special to win this game. And all we heard in the hype train for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, really throughout the playoffs was really just an absolute adulation of Joe Burrow. I watched the game and I said, I don't see what he really did that was special in this game. It was a pretty blah, vanilla performance from him. But then I looked at some of the advanced stats from the game, and the Rams had the highest pass rush win rate, okay, against the Bengals offensive line, the Rams defenders, of any team in any NFL game this year in the Super Bowl. The Bengals did a worse job of protecting Joe Burrow than any other team in all the, 280 other NFL games this year. The Bengals did the worst job of every team in every game. And when I considered that, if you think about it, it really is amazing that the Bengals even had a chance to be in this game, to steal this game, really could have very well won this game. What was your takeaway for Joe Burrow's performance in the context of really how bad that offensive line played?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head in the context of how bad that offensive line played. And then when you factor in the sprained MCL in the second half that he wound up ultimately playing through. I think it's really a surprise that he performed as well as he did. And that Bengals team held up as well as he did. And, to your point at the beginning of the segment, Burrow certainly didn't do anything flashy or overwhelming to dominate the game. But in his first, Super Bowl experience as a second year quarterback, he definitely didn't do anything to lose it either. And you could argue that there were plenty of quarterbacks that if they were under the circumstances, under that type of pressure, under, that type of just brutal, physicality all game, including the injury he suffered, a lot of quarterbacks, might have mailed it in. That game could have got out of hand for many a team. So I do got to give it to Joe Burrow that I think he showed toughness. I think he showed resilience. I'm sad that they lost, but it reminded me of almost like a Brady situation where, hey, he walked off the field with his team ahead and he needed his defense to make a stop. And we can debate that first pass interference call on the 3rd and 8 or 9, whatever it was. That was very clearly some sort of makeup call or blown call, whatever you want to call it. But again, Joe Burrow left the field with his team ahead, in a position to win the game.
Yeah, I mean, I would even go so far as to say that if you really look at it and you really think about it and you really look at what the Rams defense did to that Bengals offensive line, that Burrow actually did do a lot to win that game. Because now I agree, I don't think he did anything flashy. There was nothing magical, but what he did do was he got rid of the ball quick. And he made quick decisions. And I think he kept his team in the game because of the way he played, even though it wasn't flashy and it wasn't so apparent. That was quality quarterback play, given the circumstance. He was getting rid of the ball. I mean, there was another advanced stat, I think 2.37 seconds, which was one of the fastest times of all the games in the league this year as well. So he was really getting the ball out of his hands super quick. Unfortunately for Burrow and the Bengals, what happened in that game is they reached a point where they couldn't get away with that anymore, where those opportunities, they had to score, and it really put Burrow in a vulnerable situation where that's when he started getting sacked and ultimately injured because of that. So, you know, it really brings us back to the question we debated back in the summer when we, I think one of the first episodes of the podcast was, were the Bengals right to take Ja'Marr Chase versus Penei Sewell, the tackle from Oregon? And I think we all agree now, or most people do, that, yeah, obviously you get a chance to get a player like Chase and what they did, and he was the rookie of the year. That was the right decision. But to that point, what we saw back then was a huge glaring hole and weakness in that Bengals offensive line. What we saw back then was, you know, another number one quarterback who's at risk of becoming the next Andrew Luck, the next Derek Carr. You could go down the list, the next so-and-so, because he didn't have the protection in front of him. And the Bengals go into this offseason, emerge from this game, really, they have a gaping hole in their franchise, which is they can't protect their franchise quarterback. And it's really going to, I think, affect Burrow's future if they don't figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think this franchise knows what they have to do. And if they don't know what they have to do, that's a real shame. But no, look, I expect them to go and address the situation this offseason. I would kind of argue, and, you know, you may disagree, but I could be completely wrong here. But I feel like, you know, having to find a defense and an offensive line, those are two areas that I think you can address in free agency, potentially, you know, in via trade better than some areas. You know what I mean? I think it's a lot tougher to address that need, you know, for some other positions. So I between the draft in free agency and trade, I think they could definitely beef up that O-line and that defense a little bit. They clearly have to. You know, when you look at the way that Cooper Kupp and Matt Stafford single-handedly exposed Eli Apple in that secondary in the last drive. You know, there was just absolutely no stopping him. That team's still a few pieces away. But I think they realize the type of talent they have in their hands. I think Ja'Marr Chase is definitively worth it. And I think they will get him the help that he deserves. Now, the question is, you know, in to me, I just have a weird feeling that this team could be a regression candidate for next year, even if they do.
Oh, yeah. No question.
You know what I mean? Like, even if they do get better on the O-line and on defense, like, I think it would take a lot for this team to repeat and win the division and make it back to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to your first point, I mean, you look across the league, and I think, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you could argue that skill position talent was overrated. I think this is one of the things Belichick's really failing to catch up with, is that, you know, you could win Super Bowls with Deion Branch and David Givens in 2004. You know, it's, you look now, the teams that are making deep runs, they have weapons at the skill positions. I mean, that top end skill position talent is hard to come by. So you get a chance to draft a player like Ja'Marr Chase, who is as good a skill position player as there is in the NFL. You have to take that chance and figure it out from there. I think that you're right. I mean, they don't need to get their offensive line to be, you know, the 1992 Dallas Cowboys, you know, with five Hall of Famers or four Hall of Famers. Like, if they could just get some average guard play and some average play on that middle of that line, Burrow is a good enough and a smart enough player that he's going to be able to work with that. What you saw in the Bengals in the playoffs this year, and you saw it in Tennessee, and you saw it a little bit in Kansas City, and you definitely saw it in the Super Bowl, was you saw bad offensive line play. It was literally bad. And that particular right guard was just, you know, I mean, he was a total liability. So if they can upgrade a little, either through trades, through free agency, you know, they're going to be drafting at the end of the rounds. Guess what? Great guards and centers, you know, are often available at the end of the first round. And that's really what they need. So I think they had to, they made the right choice. And I think it is possible for them to build. But, you know, they are a young team. They have a lot of parts in motion, if you will. And I think that it is possible that they could well take a step back next year. That kind of segues perfectly, I guess, into the next question I was going to ask you. And I think you already kind of answered it. But which team, Justin, do you think has a better chance to return to a Super Bowl in the near future? Is it the Rams or is it the Bengals? It sounds like you don't think it's the Bengals.
Well, actually, to be completely honest, in the context of this question, I do think it's the Bengals because I don't see how this Rams team is able to keep, you know, keep the band together much longer than they have. Someone like Aaron Donald, as crucial as he is, talking about retirement. You know, guys like Von Miller on their last leg, other guys that need to get paid. You know, you're about to lose some key pieces on the O-line, Andrew Whitworth retiring. So, look,
there's OBJ, OBJ, right? He was only a one-year contract. He was huge for them.
Right, he massive, absolutely massive, even though he got hurt, even the impact he made just on that second drive, just scoring that touchdown. So, I mean, yeah, look, and not only that, but this is a team that, not only is their roster aging and they're about to face, you know, major challenges, but they don't have the assets to rebuild. I think all of the, I think the Rams and Matt Stafford, they all know. And I think that's one of the reasons why Aaron Donald said that if they won, he would retire. It's because I think they knew this was their shot. And if it didn't happen, it was probably never going to happen, at least in the near future. So I actually, even though I slightly in my gut think the Bengals could regress a little bit next year, I do think they'd be likely to get back to a Super Bowl before the Rams would. I think the Bengals are probably another maybe 2, 3, even 4 years away from getting back, but I think they will. I really do.
Yeah. I would actually go with the Rams, and I hear what you're saying about, you know, some of the challenges they're going to face, but they have a pretty solid core of players. And of course, when I say the Rams, I'm saying that on the assumption that Aaron Donald is going to be back, because obviously he's a game changing player. I mean, he's the guy that makes the whole, you know, stirs the whole drink, you know, on that defense. If he's not there, then it's a totally different game. But I think the Rams have a really solid core of top level players. I think they have a very good quarterback, maybe not a great one, but a very good one. And I think they can plug in the pieces around them to fill some of those holes. I think the Rams will have a shot to be an influence, a factor in the NFC again this year coming up. Whereas I think the Bengals are, you know, going into a super competitive AFC. I just feel like it seems logical. It just feels like they might regress a little. They caught lightning in a bottle this year. Let's not make the assumption that they're going to be able to do that again. I think the Rams are right there, and they're going to knock on the door again. Now, you know, will the Rams be able to keep this going? I mean, given the way they've built their team, which is totally foregoing the draft in every possible way, like we've never seen an NFL franchise just totally forego the draft like the Rams have done the last 5 years. I mean, they haven't made a first-round pick in 6 years now. I mean, that's going to be really one of the interesting questions moving forward. Can they keep robbing from Peter to pay Paul, right, in a way that stocks their roster with talent? It's something we talked about a couple times this year, and I think it's going to be really one of the interesting questions. And I also think it's going to be interesting, Justin, to see if other teams play copycat and follow that model. I don't know what you think about the Rams model, but like, I kind of feel like it's not stupid. I mean, I guess to put it in colloquially, because, and look, they're trading and they're bringing in proven veteran talent. You know, first round draft picks are failing probably 40-ish, 50% of the time. They're trading their first round picks for guys they know are going to be able to produce for them right now. And they're hitting on mid and late round picks that are big contributors. And I think that's a huge part of it too. If you look at it, and Belichick's kind of been doing this for years, you know, it's better to have 3 fourth round picks than 1 second is the Bill Belichick model. And McVay seems to have adopted that, but taking it to an even another level, where he's just totally foregoing the draft. I think we've talked about it once or twice before in the past, but we got to comment it on again, or you got to comment it on again. What do you think about the Rams model, Justin, and the way that they built that team? Will it sustain, and will teams try to copycat it?
I mean, look, it's a very interesting dynamic, because I don't think there's any argument that, you know, it gives you one of the better, if not the best chance to win right now or in the immediate, you know, future. But by the same token, it's very risky because just like we were talking about with the Rams, if you don't win right now, you've pretty much mortgaged your franchise's future. And, you know, if it doesn't pay off at the Super Bowl, then you look like idiots, right? And, another thing I think when it comes to, this strategy is it's only something I feel like that could work in a market like LA or another big market team like that. You know what I mean? Because, people like Jalen Ramsey, whatnot, they wanted to go to LA to be in LA. Odell wanted to go to LA to be in LA. You know what I mean? It's a strategy that's a lot tougher to employ in a small
in Jacksonville
exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? So yeah. I think you have to be, you got to be very careful. I think to be completely honest too, in order to even consider that strategy, I think you have to have built your team up enough through the draft and free agency that you are a few pieces away and able to mortgage, you know, the future to bring in a couple of missing links, and make that push. So it's clearly very risky. And I think we will probably see a few teams, you know, try to do it in the future, but it's one of those things where, hey, the Rams could have looked like big idiots if it didn't pay off. And, it's going to be interesting to see how they recover, you know, moving forward.
I'll tell you right now, Justin, I'll tell you, like, I think what the Rams are did is genius. And I thought that before they won a Super Bowl. I mean, if you really think about it, right, you take such gambles on these draft picks and so often do they not work out. McVay has basically said, I'm not even going to play with the draft. I'm bringing in proven veteran talent and I can find enough guys in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth round of the draft that I can plug them in and I will find players there, maybe not as often, but I will find them and I can make a super competitive team. And I think he's 100% right. I think he's beating the system. He has just totally realized that first round draft picks are super overrated. Like, I don't need another freaking N'Keal Harry or Sony Michel on my team. I'll take the proven veteran talent that I can go out and get it for, and then I'll take a chance on four or five mid-round picks that I'm going to find one Cooper Kupp or that I'm going to find one Aaron Donald in there. And you know what? That takes great drafting to back that up, granted. But I'm sorry. Look across the league. Many of the best players in the league, where are they drafted? Third round, fourth round, fifth round, sixth round. All up and down the league, NFL rosters are filled with star players that are mid to late round draft picks. McVay is throwing the system upside down because he has realized that a first round pick is not all that it's cracked up to be, and that these mid and late round picks are worth more than people realize they're worth. And in doing this, I think he has built a system that is actually, you know, highly effective. And will it be sustainable? I don't know. It feels weird. It feels like it's going to fall apart. But other side of the coin, all these things fall apart. That's the nature of the league. They're not meant to last that long. The bottom line is the Rams are on like a 5 or 6 year run now that's really rivaling anyone in the NFL's last 5 or 6 years. I think they've made the playoffs 5 years in a row. They've been to a Super Bowl. They've won a Super Bowl. What they're doing is working. And I think inevitably other GMs are going to take notice. Honestly, I think it's really smart.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's smart because it gives you the best chance to win right now, right? I think what we're going to have to see, and this is like, you know, we don't have like the longevity study on this yet, is what does the rebuilding process look like for a team that's gone ahead and mortgaged their whole future, right? So, you know, I'd be very curious to see, you know, what that kind of entails, you know, how long do you become a bottom tier franchise for, and is it something that you're able to recover from? Again, when you're in LA, it obviously helps because even at a bottom tier franchise, people want to go out to LA to, you know, live and play there, be part of that market. So it helps, but I'm going to be very curious to see, you know, watch the next 3 to 5 years, maybe even
seven. When I was growing up, Justin, before you were a fan, like teams made like 5-year plans. It was like a 5-year league, right? And then it kind of transitioned to like a 3-year league for a long time, 2000s, 2010s. Right now, if you really think about it, you could argue that it's like a 1 to 2 year league. And that's like, and that's all you can really plan and account for. The system, the way it's set up right now with free agency and the cap being what it is, which I think is less of a factor, frankly, than it's been in the past because it is higher proportionally. You know, like McVay has just maybe realized that the concept of a 5-year, 7-year plan is dead. Okay. The Dallas Cowboys of the 90s, those teams really don't exist anymore. And really build your team from year to year and bring in high-end proven talent to do it, and then supplement your roster, hit on a few of those mid-round picks, you get lucky and you've got a good team. I think he's really onto something, but you're right. It's going to fall apart at some point, because inevitably it does. I mean, if the Rams go on another, you know, 2-3 year run where they're making the playoffs each time, and this becomes a 6-7-8 year run, you know, hey, maybe they even win another Super Bowl. That might sound, that's a lot, you know, it's crazy. But I mean, you're going to have to call it, I think, a successful approach at some point, even if it does fall apart inevitably.
Success. Right. And again, the fact that the Rams were kind of one of the first teams that I can remember, you know, in recent memory to go all in and employ this strategy, and they happened to win one, which again, a lot of things had to go right for them to win one. You know, I still think that potentially if the Bucs were healthy, they could have got by them. It was very arguably, you know, the 49ers were so close to getting by them. Our 49ers were one play away from getting by them. So look, that's a team that got lucky. All the stars had to align. You know, they had to wind up playing, you know, what I would consider not a powerhouse out of the AFC. So yeah, I mean, look, I think the Rams ultimately benefited from a lot of luck, a lot of fortune. And again, hey, they won a Super Bowl. Congrats. So you can say the strategy works, but I'd be curious to see, you know, if it's repeated in the future for multiple franchise and different markets, just how successful it is, you know, how often teams actually do win Super Bowls from it. And then again, how long does it take to recover from, you know, that cycle?
Yep, it's a copycat league. You know, when the Giants won the Super Bowl in 1991 with Otis Anderson, you know, everyone wanted to be a power running team. When you know, I mean, you can go all throughout the history of the league, the last 30 plus years, it's a copycat league. So it's going to be super interesting to see what happens when teams copy this model. And you know what, Justin, one thing we haven't said yet and we should say is give credit to Sean McVay, because he's done it right. And he brought, and you know, you raise a great point. Other teams might try to copycat what the Rams do, and they might completely blow up in their face and turn into a disaster. What he's doing is so unorthodox, and he's able to pull it off because of his skill and his talent. Maybe other teams that try to do this, it would turn into the disaster that common sense might say that it would be, you know, trading away all your draft picks. So you got to give credit to McVay.
Yeah, you do. And I got to say, didn't McVay just, he looked so nervous that entire game, especially in the second half, once Cincinnati came out strong. He was sweating. He was sweating so hard. And if I was him, I would have been too.
Yeah, but you know what? And we should talk about him. I was going to bring him up. So since you mentioned it, I mean, even though I agree with that, I mean, he was a little tight, and he was definitely a little tight in 2018 against the Patriots, and I think it really cost them. You got to give this guy a ton of credit. He's a terrific coach. You know, I think he's 36 years old. He's been to a Super Bowl. He's won a Super Bowl. They've won multiple games pretty much every year he's been the coach. And, oh, by the way, they did a lot of that with freaking Jared Goff as their quarterback. He's come up with a model and a system that is completely unorthodox in terms of acquiring personnel that's working. Where is Sean McVay right now, Justin, in the hierarchy of NFL coaches? Is he the best coach in the NFL right now? Is he the up and coming next thing? Does he have a chance to be the next great coach? You know, Bill Parcells, Joe Gibbs, Jimmy Johnson, Mike Shanahan had his run. Now it's Belichick, obviously. McVay is kind of positioned to be that next guy if he keeps this up, what he's done the last 5 years. Where's McVay in the hierarchy right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not ready to say he's the best coach in the NFL yet, for sure. I mean, you still got guys that, true veterans that bring it each year. I still love, obviously, Belichick. You know, you got to give Reed his props. Guys like Vrabel, guys like Harbaugh. I love those guys, honestly. I love what Harbaugh did in Baltimore this year. I love what Vrabel did in Tennessee this year. I mean, I don't think you can overlook coaches like that. I think McVay is certainly at the top of the league. I don't think I'm ready to call him the best, though. But look, as far as his future goes, I think it's very important to ask ourselves, how long is this rebuild going to take? Because if McVay has 3 or 4, sub 500 or even, middling around 500 seasons, and they're missing the playoffs and, they're not doing this and that. I mean, do people turn on him? Does LA turn on him? Like, does his reputation and legacy start to change? So it's going to be, I think very interesting to see if he stays coaching, because some people were talking about him potentially moving to a front office role somewhere and getting out of coaching. But I think it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens to him. And, especially with that Rams team moving forward.
Well, we've seen before that great coaches or good coaches have come in, won one single Super Bowl, but didn't really turn into that next thing. I mean, you could come up with a dozen names. Brian Billick. Mike McCarthy. I mean, guys that might not even have been that great of coaches, but they were able to win a Super Bowl and have a pretty good couple year run, and then it all fall apart. What I find impressive about McVay and what he's going to need to do is he's going to need to carry things forward, bringing in multiple pieces and parts. What I find impressive about him is that he's already really been able to do that. And I would say, especially at the quarterback position, this is a guy that made a Super Bowl with Jared Goff as his quarterback. We all know Jared Goff is not a good quarterback. I mean, there's no question about it. And now he took a guy in Matt Stafford who was a disappointment, really, frankly, his whole career. And it really been up and down. He put up some big numbers, but was nothing special, and certainly wasn't winning games. And now he's turned him into a Super Bowl champion. So I think that is a really great indicator of what kind of coach he really is. But as you alluded to, he's going to have to sustain it over another stretch. He's going to have to win more than one ring. They're going to have to rebuild this team on the fly and make another Super Bowl runs and really be in it to get that to that next level echelon. But he's a young guy who's won a Super Bowl, and he is positioned, I think, to potentially be that next person. So it will be interesting to see what he's able to do, in the coming years.
It will be. And sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but you know what? By the same token, we can look at it too and say that if, that kind of ridiculous 3rd-and-8 pass interference wasn't called on the Bengals, that we could be looking at this and saying, wow, McVay blew it again. And he blew it against the Bengals. And what is this team going to do? And what does that say for McVay's legacy? So, McVay escaped this season in the Super Bowl in particular, I think, by the skin of his teeth. I'm not ready to just shove him up there on a pedestal just yet, because I think we all would have been absolutely just dumping on him had they dropped this game to the Bengals, and they were very close to, arguably a play or two away. So I think I'm going to need to see him continue to not only sustain the success that he's had recently, but, see how we can do it during a rebuild.
You're right, but remember too, Justin, the Rams have won multiple games, like 4 of the last 5 years. I mean, they've been in the playoffs every year. Like, I don't think it's totally fair to say it's luck, because when you're knocking on the door every year, eventually you're going to catch a few breaks and you're going to break the door down. And yes, I mean, did they catch breaks and luck? Yeah, of course they did. But this is a team that's been a perennial playoff team that this year got the breaks, you know, to win a ring. It's not like this is a team that made the playoffs once and everything went their way. I mean, they've been scratching at the door for half a decade now and had made deep playoff runs, been to a Super Bowl before. They were right there. So, you know, it's not just luck. I mean, it's luck, but eventually if you're there enough times, luck's going to happen.
Yeah. And I agree. But, you know, I also think too, like if you employ this all out strategy of bringing in, you know, these superstars and having a stacked roster. I mean, even with Jared Goff, the Rams had a stacked roster the last couple of years. So I would expect you to be able to do that. Again, I think it's going to be a real test to see what he's able to do in terms of consistently winning and making the playoffs, you know, when some of those stars leave and he is left to nothing but, you know, the draft and free agency.
Well, maybe, Justin, this is a good time to segue to really the biggest star they brought in and the big name they brought in, probably the real big catalyst for why they're actually holding the trophy this year instead of falling just short. And that's Matthew Stafford. The decision to bring in Stafford was a big, big gamble. And I think Stafford is as interesting a player maybe as there is in the NFL right now, because he showed flashes in Detroit, but he could just never quite put it together. And there was this sort of age-old question about whether it was Stafford that brought down, that lifted up Detroit a little, or was Detroit that brought down Stafford? You know, was Stafford really a franchise guy that was just being absolutely suffocated by a terrible franchise, or was actually Stafford really not as good as some of his big numbers at times would indicate? Well, now we've seen him win a Super Bowl with the Rams, and I think, you know, where he falls into the quarterback tree, the quarterback hierarchy, is one of the big questions that emerges from this Super Bowl. But I personally would not consider Stafford to be a Hall of Famer. I think that Stafford is a good quarterback, not a very good quarterback, but I don't think he's a great one by any means. Justin, what's your take on Stafford? Where does he land, and is he a Hall of Fame quarterback?
I mean, the Hall of Fame quarterback debate, you know, that's a really interesting one. I've heard a lot of people weigh in on it, including Richard Sherman. That one to me is something I'm not ready to call a verdict on. I'd like to see actually another year or two of how Stafford performs in LA now that he's out of Detroit. But I do admire Stafford's toughness. I know he had to put up with years of crap with one of the worst franchises in the NFL. He had very little help. He battled through injuries, you know, in a tough nosed division, never easy playing in places like Green Bay and Chicago. So I do got to give him his credit. He's one of the veterans of the league. You know, You never really hear anything wrong. He's never, you know, getting into trouble or, you know, kind of, you know, bringing negative publicity or attention to him or his team. You know, he seems like a good guy. He seems like his players like him. So I'm happy for him. I have nothing bad to say really about Matt Stafford, other than the fact that I don't look at this season and say, oh, one of the greatest of all time, sign him up for the Hall of Fame. I just look at it.
I agree.
You know?
1,000%.
I look at it and I say, hey, this was a good quarterback who paid his dues. He battled and he got put on a Super Bowl ready roster. And, you know, they were able to catch fire at the right time and had some of the right matchups.
Do you think, as I watched the Super Bowl, I watched all three of their playoff games, watched a lot of their games in the regular season. To me, Justin, and this is just me, you can tell me if I'm wrong, to me, it was the same Matt Stafford we've always seen. And you look right in that postseason run. You know, you keep saying about the Rams' luck. Well, the biggest lucky break they got was what? It was in the NFC Championship game. Matt Stafford threw one of the worst passes I've ever seen, should have been intercepted, was like a softball punt, and the 49ers defender dropped it. He threw two picks in the Super Bowl. Yeah. The biggest difference really was that the team around him was much better. The coaching was much better. He had much more support and it was able to overcome the few mistakes he made. It doesn't mean he's not a very good player. He's a very good player, and he can make throws that, that almost no other quarterback in the league can make. He's got tremendous arm talent. He puts, you know, he puts up big numbers. He makes plays, but he also makes terrible mistakes. And I think you saw that consistently this year with him, and certainly in those last few postseason games. You know, to me, it was the same Matt Stafford as always. It was the team around him that was better. He was, he's a good quarterback, and you can win with him. But he's not a great one, and he's mistake prone.
Yeah, 100%. I don't think, you know, I wouldn't call him, you know, one of the greatest at all. I wouldn't even necessarily call him one of the greatest in the league right now. I think it's exactly what you said. I think he's a good quarterback that can win games. And he was, he just happened to be in a much better team with much better coaching. And it, I don't think, you know, we have to overcomplicate it. I think if you're someone who wants to say that Matt Stafford is this end all be all great quarterback, oh my God, wow. I mean, look, you know, that that's your opinion, you're entitled, but I just don't see it. And I'm going to need to see extended, you know, success with this franchise in order to, you know, give that the kind of seal of approval.
I absolutely. And you just, and you referenced a great point, but it's worth mentioning. He's only 34 years old, I think. So he's got a lot of football left ahead of him. And I will say this, if he goes out and wins another title or, you know, or really does some great things with the Rams, that then you can go back and look at, relook at it. But right now, to me, no way, shape or form is this guy a Hall of Famer. He's never been one of the best players in the league. He's never been one of the best quarterbacks in the league. And Richard Sherman said it. I love Richard Sherman because he always says the truth. He's outspoken. And I like the guy. He said it. It's an era where volume-based statistics lie about quality play. Matt Stafford put up a lot of volume-based statistics in Detroit because he was throwing a ton. They were always down by two or three scores. He was not – it doesn't mean he was playing the position quality. I'm not saying, again, he was bad. I'm just saying he wasn't great. And he's got the opportunity now to shut up all his doubters in the Rams. He took a huge step towards that by winning a ring. If this guy goes out and has a 5-year run to finish his career where he wins another title, they're in the playoffs almost every year. He's throwing 35 touchdowns and 14 picks every year, whatever he did this year, then you know what? I'll re-amend this take and I'll admit it. The guy deserves to be a Hall of Famer. But right now, I'm sorry. You can't put him in based on one ring.
Yeah, agreed. I'm in the same boat for sure.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit, Justin, about, the refereeing in the game, because that's something you alluded to. What was your take on that pass interference call in a critical spot, third and goal from the 9? That's one of the toughest spots to be in. You know, when you're in goal situation from 7, 8, 9, 10 plus yards out, that's a horrible spot. The Rams were about to be in fourth and goal, and that little flag came on the field after really not calling anything the whole game. I thought it was a horrible call. I thought it was a ticky-tack call. And I thought in any situation, I think it was terrible. But given the fact that they had kept their flags in their pocket for 56 minutes, I thought it was an absolute abomination that call got called in that spot. Justin, what do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. And you hit on a great point, which is that I actually, to that point in the game, was very happy with the refereeing. I thought they were letting them play. I didn't think they were, over refereeing the game and calling too many penalties and being ticky-tack. I was actually very happy. I mean,
yep,
the only reason that I can see them justifying that call, because like you said, it was so out of character for the way that they were calling that game, is because maybe they felt deep down that they blew a call on that T. Higgins offensive pass interference and that, you know, hey, that play was the game changer and they owed them a makeup call. And I'm not, you know, we can argue.
No, you got the directionality backwards, though. That call screwed the Rams. And you're right. Yeah, maybe you owed them a
you know what I'm saying? Call. So right. So I'm
you're
so
right, you're right.
That's the only, and again, like we can argue like the ethics in, you know, the place and the time and place for makeup calls, and do they have their place in sports? You know, if you feel like as a ref you blew a prior call. I think that's a whole separate conversation. But if you are so inclined to call what, you know, would probably be considered a makeup call, you can't do it right there. You just can't, because that momentum swing from going from potentially fourth and nine to first and 10 on the goal line is, you're literally just taking the dial and you're moving it from all the way at one end of the spectrum to all the way in the other end of the spectrum. It just went from being a very, very unlikely chance that the Rams win to a very, very unlikely chance that the Rams lose. And you hate to see the refs be responsible for that, especially on a call that, like you said, was not only very ticky-tacky, but very uncharacteristic for the way they were calling the rest of the game. If they were calling the whole game that way, I still wouldn't like it, but I could understand it.
Right. Agreed. You keep your flag in your pocket for 56 minutes. Don't screw the pooch with 4 minutes left in the game on that big of a spot. I mean, I don't know what, like, historically the probability that a fourth and nine from the 9 yard line results in a touchdown, but I guarantee you it's probably less than 10%. I mean, that's a low probability play, because you got a really short field, 11 defenders. That's a tough spot for an offense. And that was the ultimate bailout call. In that spot, you know, it was really just unconscionable and so frustrating as a fan. And you're watching objectively. I didn't really feel strongly rooting for either team in this game. And maybe that was part of why, to go back to the first thing we talked about, the other reason why I was so apathetic, neither team polarizing. You don't really love or hate, you know, either side. They were just kind of vanilla. But you're not really rooting for either side, but you want to see good product, and you hate to see the referees more or less, I don't want to say decide the game, but give one of the two teams a huge advantage in a key spot. Now on a questionable call. Now the call after that on the Cooper Kupp one by the pylon, that was a legit call on Eli Apple. That was the right call. I mean, he held him. So I had no problem with that. This is a totally different animal. Bad call, big mistake, bad look for the league. It was what it was.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely a bad look. And I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I'm just, you just hate to see a game decided like that. You do. And I mean, the Rams, wait, they came out on top. It is what it is. You can argue that if the offensive pass interference was called against T. Higgins, that they'd never be in that situation. So, hey, I mean, that's the way it happens, but you hate to see it.
The other side of the coin, though, too, I mean, and let's remember this. The Bengals had many chances to win that game. They got another chance after that play. There was, like, plenty of time left. On that fourth and one play that that Aaron Donald sacked Joe Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase was wide open. Why couldn't Joe Burrow get him the ball? The same reason that he couldn't get him the ball but for the rest of the game, because he had Aaron Donald in his face. The Rams, you know, the Rams couldn't be blocked. The Bengals couldn't block. So the Bengals definitely had a lot of chances. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it gave the game to the Rams, but it bailed them out. It really did of a terrible spot. And if let's face it, if the ref doesn't make that call, you're probably looking at a Bengals Super Bowl victory. I mean, for better or for worse. Justin, let's talk a little bit about the Rams and their fans. We alluded to this earlier. I think it merits some discussion. The LA Rams have been in Los Angeles about the same time that the St. Louis Rams were in St. Louis when they won their first Super Bowl. I think the St. Louis Rams were there for 6 years, and I think LA Rams have now been there for just 5 or 6 years. When the Rams won their Super Bowl, you should see the photos. There was a million fans in the street. You know, we all saw the photos on social media from LA fans this week. There was hardly anyone at the parade. It doesn't feel like the Rams are taking hold in Los Angeles. What is the league going to do about the LA market? And as bad as it is for the Rams, let's remember, it's even worse for the Chargers. The Chargers have even less fan support than the Rams, and that's saying something. What is the NFL doing with two franchises in that market? What are they going to do?
Yeah, someone really dropped the ball there, because I was going to say, like, it's tough enough, you know, one franchise trying to get support there, but both of these franchises, like, neither of them has a stranglehold. Neither of them are able to excite the city. Now, One thing that I think is interesting, you know, to note is that they, you know, you had both teams kind of moving there in, you know, rising to, you know, be competitive teams in the league during the height of COVID, right? So I think the COVID-19 pandemic could definitely, especially, you know, in somewhere like LA that is still, you know, kind of heavily involved with the, you know, the restrictions and the mandates and whatnot. I can see how that plays, you know, maybe a slight effect in terms of attendance with, you know, big, large social gatherings like sporting events and parades. So, you know, I can kind of understand that, but by the same token, you know, you still see what happened amidst the pandemic in all these other markets that have truly dedicated fans that love them. And it seemed like, you know, when you looked at all the other teams in the league, that stadiums are still filling up and people were still, you know, tailgating and people wanted to root for their fans. So diehard football fans, you know, still wanted to support their team. But LA just, they don't have that diehard fan base. It's going to be, it's super tough, I think, to, you know, just create it artificially out of thin air. You know, they'll probably get some bandwagon fans now moving forward after winning, which I guess is the best case scenario for them. But yeah, they're having a real problem. And yeah, I mean, hopefully, you know, as, like I said, hopefully maybe as the pandemic goes away, you know, more and more people will be attending, you know, sporting events out there and things like that. But it's definitely tough. We're definitely, you know, not seeing the diehard support that you would hope in a major market that just committed itself to two franchises.
I want to tell you what I see as the root cause of this whole mess. And I haven't heard anybody mention this because I've heard a lot of talk about the Rams and their fans and the NFL's role in the LA market. But this was all set in motion, Justin, by the fact that the NFL awarded an expansion franchise to the Jacksonville Jaguars in the mid-90s. Okay, that was the biggest mistake the NFL has made in the last 50 years. Jacksonville is not an NFL market. It should not have an NFL team. It has no business having an NFL team. That is one of the most poorly supported teams in all of professional sports, in a rinky-dink C+, I don't even know if I can call it a B-level market, okay? And why is that relevant to this? Because by putting a team into Jacksonville, that is what brought the Rams to St. Louis in 1995 and left a gaping hole in the LA market for like 22 years, okay? The LA Rams should have never left LA. That expansion team that went to Jacksonville should have went to St. Louis and they'd still be there today. The fans in St. Louis got screwed, okay? And the LA Rams, they kind of had a legit fan base in the early 90s. That all went away. All those people get alienated, gone now, 25 years later. I get why the NFL wants to be in LA. I get putting the Rams back in there. Totally understand it. It's going to be a rocky road for the NFL to build up that fan base in that market. They need to be in LA, but what they don't need is two teams in LA. What do you think about the Chargers? Like, how do you, can they move the Chargers back to San Diego? I mean, as bad as it is for the Rams, let's not forget the LA Chargers are even less supported.
Yeah, I 100%. I mean, it's really tough. And, you know, look, the one thing that those two teams have going for them, again, is the fact that they're in a market like LA, and even without great fan support, they're still going to attract, you know, free agents in big names. That's just going to be a place where people want to go just because of the nature of the city. But, you know, are we actually that surprised, though? Because, I mean, just looking back to LA fans, you know, the history of LA fans. I mean, even just look at like Lakers and whatnot. Like, LA's had some of the worst fans, like, historically. So I'm not surprised that, you know, they're all kind of just taking a back seat with this Rams team. I don't hate the fact that, okay, you return a franchise that was in LA back to LA, you know, in hopes that, you know, you kind of rekindle the flame out there. But it's just typical LA. It's what we've seen out of their fans in multiple sports over the years. And, you know, the having the Chargers there is just awful. And I feel bad for the Chargers, like you said. I don't even know why they left San Diego in the first place.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. And honestly, Justin, I agree with you. Like, I think the NFL needs to be in LA. And I think the LA Rams, you know, having lived through that, the LA Rams should have never left LA in the early 90s. I mean, I was very young at the time, but, you know, I mean, it was a huge mistake. They should have never left LA. That expansion franchise that went to Jacksonville should have went to St. Louis. Okay. You would have had stability with your franchises. Every time they pick up and move one of these teams, they're alienating a bunch of people. They're screwing some of their best customers, right? In some of their home markets. It's a terrible way to do business. That Jacksonville team is not going to sustain in Jacksonville. They can't. There are the writings on the wall. They're already arguing with the city in Jacksonville about a new stadium. That team's going to move. You had LA Chargers move. You had the LA Rams move. I mean, you can't keep moving these franchises. It's bad for business. At some point, it takes a diminishing effect. And I'm going to tell you something. If the Rams had played in LA for the last 30 years instead of taking a hiatus in St. Louis, they would have a legitimate fan base. What you're seeing now is a direct function of moving that franchise to St. Louis for 25 years and then trying to move them back. Well, guess what? They alienated a lot of people. They eroded a lot of their fans. They eroded a lot of their support. People find other things to do, other things to care about. And it's not going to be easy to get that trust, that support, that following back. And you saw that this week with the television ratings, with the fan support in the stadium, in the city, at the parade. Very apparent that the LA market doesn't care that much about the Rams.
Yeah, no, 100%. And we've seen it throughout the season. Even in the playoff when, you know, like I said, it was tough for them to fill stadiums. You hate to see it. And, you know, you really wonder what more they can do other than bring in the big names and win a Super Bowl. You know, I don't know what else they can do at this point. So it'd be curious to see if they're able over the next couple of years to kind of ride the wave of the Super Bowl and maybe, you know, rekindle the flame in LA and get the fans back on their side, make them passionate again about, you know, football in LA. But as of right now, like you said, certainly not the case. And it's only going to be more difficult having a second team in the mix.
Absolutely. Let's change gears a little bit, Justin, because I think we're running a little short on time and I don't want to let an entire episode of the podcast go without talking a little bit about the Patriots, where we're moving into the thick of the offseason. This is the dead zone on the NFL calendar. The NFL is like a year-round thing now. This is probably the quietest time of the year besides maybe the time in June after mini camp and before training camp. But even then, I think there's more than what there is now. Free agency coming up in a couple weeks. You know, the draft is far off in the distance and the Super Bowl is, of course, behind us. There is still some things to talk about for the Patriots. Number one on that list is this coaching staff situation that we talked about last week. It's been another week. The Patriots still haven't hired an offensive coordinator. We talked at nauseam about that last week. You know my feelings about it. I think it's a disgrace that they're going into the year without any coordinator on either side of the ball. I think it's Belichick's arrogance getting him again. He's a terrific coach, but his biggest weakness has always been he's stubborn and he's arrogant, and it's going to burn him again here. You can't go into this year. It's nuts with any team, but when you got a second year quarterback, it's extra nuts to go into the year without an offensive coordinator. I can be pragmatic about Joe Judge. I can be pragmatic about any of these guys, Adam Gase, who isn't here yet. But I can't be pragmatic about a screwed up organizational structure. And that's really what they have. But the one thought I did have, and I wanted to ask you is, you know, maybe one of the reasons, and I'm trying to make sense of this bizarre situation of going into a year with your second year quarterback with no offensive coordinator, trying to make sense of it. And one thing I came up with, Justin, I want to see what you thought about is, do you think that this could be a reflection of Belichick's confidence in Mac Jones? Maybe even not even as an on the field, but an off the field presence. And is the willingness to go into the year without a formal OC, is that really a commentary that says that Belichick has a lot of faith in Mac, at least his ability to understand the offense, be a part of decision making, play calling, etc.?
You know, it's an interesting take for sure. But I mean, you know, we've seen Bill not bring in pieces for this team before because he put the faith in, you know, some of the wrong people So, I mean, just even if that's the reason, it doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do. To me, I don't know. It's tough. It's tough to say if that's the reason. I haven't heard anything that would suggest that. I think, you know, it's obviously a fun theory to poke around with. But, you know, in your opinion, do you think that, you know, regardless of how good Mac Jones is or how, you know, good Bill thinks he could be, do you think that behooves him to not have an OC?
Yeah, you know, no, I mean, like, I think it's ridiculous. Like, I think that, I mean, I'm trying to make sense of something that I can't make sense of, which is why go into the year without an OC when you have a second year quarterback. And I'm just trying to come up with some like rationalizable way that this makes sense. What do I think it is? I think it's Belichick making a mistake. I think it's Belichick being arrogant. I think it's Belichick thinking he can do the things at 70 that he used to get away with at 50. I think it's flawed, dysfunctional, and I think it's going to blow up in their face. I really do. If they don't bring in someone else, and I'm just hoping and praying that you get a last minute surprise here. Bill O'Brien, even Adam Gase. I know that sounds crazy, but they just need someone with some experience. You know, anyone. And that's what I think, but I mean, I just throw this out there because, you know, maybe Belichick thinks Mac has something, and maybe, I mean, at the end of the day, as much as I get annoyed at Belichick, especially since the Brady thing, the reality is over the last 22 years, he's been right about a lot more than he's been wrong about. So while this doesn't make any sense to me, you know, Belichick has a track record enough that deep down inside, I still have to respect and try and figure out what he's doing and why this makes sense to a brilliant football mind, even though it doesn't make sense to me. And that's just one theory I come up with, you know?
Yeah. I mean, no, at this point, I think we just got to stop trying to go, you know, guess what's going on in Bill Belichick's mind, because he constantly shows us that he's always doing something that we as fans, look at and go, you know, what the hell, what is going on here? And I guess you mean that's like the allure of Belichick, right? Like the whole like mysticism of him is just, he always does things that we don't necessarily understand. And sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't. Why he does it, we never really know. I mean, we're still trying to figure out, you know, as fans, why Malcolm Butler didn't play against the Eagles in the Super Bowl, right? So we can speculate. We can speculate all we want. And who knows what the actual reason is. Who knows? In a few weeks, maybe the conversations change because maybe they decide to bring someone in. It's still, like you said, it's a long off season, and a lot could happen. But, you know, I guess time will tell if this is the right move.
Yep. And I'll go on record as saying that I think he has to be held accountable if it doesn't work. Okay, because this is so unorthodox and so antithetical to common sense, and there is a part of me, and this is going to sound totally nuts, and I said it last week, I'll say it again, that wonders if this was the year to cut the tie, keep McDaniels, keep Ziegler, keep the young talent here. They're losing young talent. It's because of Belichick. I think a little bit they're losing young talent. Belichick's so entrenched in this franchise. These guys leave here because they feel like they can't move through the power structure. They're never going to get the influence, the power they want, because Bill carries so much of it in the organization. I know it's nuts to say, because it's Belichick and he's still Belichick. I'm not saying I necessarily would have done it, but that thought crosses my mind. It really does. Was this the year to keep McDaniels, to keep Ziegler? You've got a young quarterback who has a great relationship with McDaniels, did a great job with him. I think the future of this franchise hinges more on Mac Jones than on Bill Belichick. I really do. And maybe this was the year that you make that crazy move and bring in someone that's younger, that's offensive minded, that's been here in McDaniels, and you make that investment in your young Q.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, I guess just to play devil's advocate to that, I would say that, you know, our big gripe with how we handled the Tom Brady situation was that we let somebody who did all that for us just, you know, walk away, and we didn't let them, you know, ride out the career as a Patriot, even if it meant a season or two of, you know, not being a Super Bowl contender, just for the sake of saying, you know, they finished their career with us and rode it out. I mean, look, we made that mistake once. I'm down to not make that mistake twice. I still have enough appreciation and respect for Belichick as a coach that I'm kind of ready to let him step down whenever he's ready, just like I wish we would have let Brady step down whenever he was ready.
Well, we'll see what happens this year and how this all works. You know, if Joe Judge, you know, I'm willing to be pragmatic about Joe Judge. If he does a good job and Jones takes those next steps, and, you know, we'll be sitting with an egg in our face. The one other quick one I will say is the rumors now that Matt Patricia might be working on the offensive side of the ball. I mean, again, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. Just a bizarre decision, not the path forward that I envision for them this year with Mac moving into his second year.
Wait, did you say Matt Patricia was going to have a role in the offense?
Yes. Yes. He had a role in the offense. That was the reporting today.
Wait, I mean, it's not it, like we have a whole in the defense, like a defensive coordinator, right? Like why would he be stepping back into a role with the offense? That doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know. I hope not.
I've never been a huge fan of his on defense. So maybe he'll be a better coach on offense than I was. All right. Let's talk very quickly. And then we're going to wrap it up just in the off season path to success. We're sitting on the verge of another off season. I don't know if you have any designs on what you would like to see the Patriots do. I want to start by asking a question, which is, would you rather sign J.C. Jackson, franchise him, or would you rather let him go and bring in a big-name free agent? And if so, where would you want that free agent to be? This team's kind of up against the cap. They might be able to create some cap room if you look at it, because some of the veterans are retiring. They're not going to have the kind of flexibility they had last year to bring in 6, 7, 8 guys. They're going to have to make some tough decisions. So would you rather bring in a marquee free agent again, or would you rather keep J.C. Jackson?
I really like J.C. Jackson. I do. I mean, what I don't understand is letting someone like J.C. Jackson walk and then replacing him with someone who's not that much cheaper. You know what I mean? Like, and we've done stuff like that before. I think J.C. Jackson's really good. And to be completely honest, I would take it a step further. I think not only should we re-sign J.C. Jackson, but we should go out and get him a counterpart that, you know, can play across from him. I actually really do like Jonathan Jones when he's healthy.
Yes. He was
a huge loss for us this year. I think he's kind of paid his dues, and I think he'd be, he deserves the chance to step up. But look, as far out of this New England team, I want to see them beef up that defense, because I think there were plenty of times this year we were a stop or two away from winning games. And obviously when it came down to the playoffs and we saw, you know, a team like Buffalo, you know, just absolutely dicing us up on defense, you know, really made you want to have that Patriots, you know, lockdown defense that we thought we were, going to have at the beginning of the year.
So you'd rather bring in J.C. Jackson back than go out into the market and bring in, like, say, a tackle or on a receiver or something?
I just don't understand how we get any better by bringing in a receiver, a tackle, but let someone like J.C. Jackson go. You know what I mean? Because I feel, you know, like we definitely need a stud on that line and a weapon for Mac Jones. But I just feel like if our offense takes a slight step forward, but our defense takes a step back, you know, how is that really going to help us, you know, net result?
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that they're actually going to, even though we've talked a lot about their lack of skill position talent, some of the issues on the offensive line, it does feel like there are more holes on the defense, especially now with some of their guys are probably going to retire, age out. You know, I actually totally agree with you on this one. I think they should bring J.C. Jackson back. You look at big money free agency in the NFL, it is a mixed bag historically. The Patriots, even though they missed on a few, Nelson Aguiar, Johnny Smith, they also hit on a few. And actually, in historical terms, they did pretty well, because you bring in guys like Matt Judon, Hunter Henry, you know, to even get a few hits on big money free agency is a win, because a lot of times when people dabble in it, it blows up in their face completely. So I don't think going out and spending a huge contract on someone is a guarantee that they're going to, you know, be the player that you want them to be. You have a top 5 cornerback in J.C. Jackson. Is he Stephon Gilmore? No, maybe not. Is he Darrell Revis from 2014? No, maybe not. But he's the next step down. He's Pro Bowl caliber. He makes plays, and you're not going to find anyone to replace him. So, you know, I think you got to pay the guy. I want him here. And then I want to supplement him, okay, with mid-level free agents on their offensive line, in their front seven. They don't need superstars. They just need good, solid players that can come in and play the roles and be part of a starting lineup. Like, I don't think you need to spend $100 million to get the next big thing. Give me a solid outside linebacker. Give me a Mike Vrabel. Give me a Rob Ninkovich. You know, that's really what the kind of guys they need in free agency.
Yeah, I agree. And the Patriots, look, the Patriots have historically been really good at finding those gap filler players in, like, you know, the second, third, fourth, fifth round, and bringing in free agents who, you know, slip through the cracks, and finding really good roles for them and kind of letting them, you know, blossom into their own and like either revive or, you know, revive their career or make a name for themselves in New England. That's kind of been part of the Patriot way all these years, along with our success, is, you know, just some of the guys that have been part of these teams that kind of come out of the woodworks. You know, so I do really think that we can fill some of those holes without going out and spending a ton of money. But it just doesn't make any sense to me when you have a homegrown Patriot like J.C. Jackson, who I think at this point has proven that, you know, you can kind of build your secondary around him. He's in the prime of his career. He hasn't had any health issues, you know, and he seems to consistently perform. So even when guys like Stephon Gilmore goes down, and he has to be, you know, thwarted into that number one role. So, you know, I do really like him, and I do want to keep him. And again, I think you can fill some of those other gaps, through less expensive means.
Absolutely. And they have, you alluded to this, they have no depth in that secondary. Like they or at least the corner position anyways. And if you lose J.C. Jackson, it will be such a setback for this team. J.C. Jackson was not the problem with this secondary. When they struggled, it wasn't, I mean, because of him. Now, I'm not saying he's a lockdown cornerback. He got beat a few times here and there. But their real issue is the fact that Jonathan Jones got hurt. They traded Gilmore. They really didn't have second, third, fourth pieces to come in and fill roles and play part. They do need another cornerback, even if they keep J.C. Jackson. I guess what I'm trying to say, you can't let him walk away. It'll be such a setback for this defense that's already going to be riddled with holes going into the season. So I hope they keep him.
Sorry, yeah, no, 100%. And I think when you look at what's happened to the Patriots before in big games when they haven't had a secondary or a shutdown corner, or even you look at just this most recent Super Bowl with someone like the Bengals who didn't have a shutdown corner available to play, and you look at what happened on clutch drives and in game time decisions, and you realize that you really do need one of those guys, at least one of those guys, especially when you're dealing with some of these high-flying offenses.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Justin. All right. Well, listen, there's going to be other things. We can get deeper into what we have for our wish list for the Patriots as the offseason goes on. I want to thank everyone that listened. I think we're going to wrap it up right now. Say goodnight. We move into the offseason. We'll see what happens. You know, I don't know when exactly we'll record again, probably sometime around free agency. This is kind of the dry spell of the year, but I want to thank everyone that listened. Justin, you got any final words?
Honestly, I think it was a fun season. You know, I think it was a very interesting season in the NFL. This was one of the first times that, you know, as NFL fans, we got to see a competitive Patriots team competing in kind of a wide open field of, you know, teams where from week to week, no one really knew who was going to emerge as, you know, the Super Bowl champion, who was going to emerge, you know, as a divisional champion, you know, champion within teams' own divisions. So it was a fun season from a football standpoint. And I think we have some great young talent in the league. When you look around at guys like Joe Burrow, guys like Mahomes, you know, some of this young talent that's starting to emerge, even at the skill positions. And I think football can hopefully be in a good place moving forward.
Absolutely, Justin. I couldn't agree more. It's great young players. As sad as it is to see Brady go, it really opens things up a lot for the next generation to really establish themselves. I mean, Brady was a perennial conference you know, championship appearance pretty much lock, more or less every year, divisional round lock every year. With him gone, it really opens the landscape up, and there's a whole new generation of guys. It's painful to see him go, but it's probably a good thing for the league as a whole. It's time to move forward, and that's what we'll do this offseason. Free agency will be up in a few weeks. We'll record again then. We'll see what the Patriots do. And if there's other news, you know, we can always get into that too. So want to thank anyone that listened. Have a great night, and we'll catch you next time.
Take it easy, guys.
All right, pick up. Bye-bye.
Later, man.